Good day, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Kopernik Global Investors Third Quarter 2018 conference call. As a reminder, today's call is being recorded. At the conclusion of today's presentation, there will be a question-and-answer session, and instructions will be given at that time. Now I would like to turn the call over to Mr. Krishnan Gaffar. Please go ahead, Mr. Gaffar.
Thank you, operator. Hello and good afternoon, everyone. Thank you again for joining us today for the third quarter 2018 conference call. My name is Krishnan Gaffar, and I have with me David Ibben, our CIO and Lead Portfolio Manager for the Kopernik Global All-Cap Strategy and Co-PM for our International Strategy. Before I pass the call over to Dave, I'd like to give everyone a quick firm update. From an overall AUM standpoint, the firm assets as of the end of the third quarter were right around $3.3 billion. This represents an impressive growth of roughly $300 million in net new assets since the beginning of the year. As we all know, value had another tough quarter, and maybe the recent uptick in value is here to stay. As value investors, we have seen value be out of here for over 10 years, with the exception of a couple of quarters in 2016, and the current severe bifurcation has presented us with what we see as an amazing opportunity. We strongly believe our portfolios are well-positioned to take advantage of this bifurcation, as we currently own what we think are extremely valuable franchises at what we believe to now be trading at deep, deep discounts. Please note, Dave will be referring to a presentation which can be found on our website at kopernikglobal.com under the News and Views section. With that, I'll be handing the call over to Dave. Dave?
Okay. Thanks, Krishnan, and thanks to everybody for joining us. Continues, as always, to be interesting times in the market. Maybe more interesting than most. This chart here probably says it all. For those who view the world as linear, I guess it's easy. You can take a ruler and extend out the blue line, which is the performance of growth, and predict good things for growth in the future. They can take the ruler and put it on the line for value and predict the continuation of the current highway to hell. As you know, we here try not to think of the world as linear. We think of it as cyclical. We've had a lot of presentations of late talking about cyclicality in the world, and that's what we'll be talking about today. For those who view things as cyclical, you can see this is probably the longest and deepest underperformance of value ever. One can't help but be pretty excited by that. In the meantime, as we know, this too shall pass. While we wait for the inevitable turn, we can cry or we can laugh. We've decided that in recent presentations to have a sense of humor about it. We know we live in a market where people are viewing passive as a bunch of modern technology and robots investing efficiently in an already very efficient market. Active investors, of course, are on their way to extinction. Of the few people that are active managers, there's growth that have had quite a wonderful 10 years, and then there's people's views of value investing. Then within that, we'll later talk about different types of value investing. Really, this is a fantastic time because this is a very bifurcated market. If it's as bifurcated as we think it is, people have a choice of buying really, really expensive things or buying really attractive bargains, and we'll start with the first. First, one more slide on value. That massive outperformance of growth, and you can see how long and how steep it's been, still doesn't get it back to outperforming over the long term. Over any long period of time, value has done better. This certainly is a long period now that the growth's done better. Growth's done so well that people really ought to think hard about what they're buying. Past growth markets, which have tended to go along with rapid money growth by central banks around the world, created a bubble in the late '60s, early '70s, Nifty 50 stocks. They created a bubble in '99 that many of you will remember. and the current bubble that many people are calling the bubble in everything, in a market where growth has done very well, the U.S. has done very well, momentum has done extremely well. As the 10-year period where the NASDAQ's gone up over 7 times the NASDAQ 100, that's massive, 7 times. Okay, people can say, you guys are value, so it's not about price, it's about value. We say we agree, it's okay for things to go up, but the fundamentals go up right with it. Housing can go up if rent prices go up, and many things can go up if people's ability to pay for those things goes up. This shows stocks versus how much people make working for a living. You can see how extreme that got in 1999, and you can see how badly that ended. This, as you can see, is way worse than 1999, but this is wages. We could look at it versus rents. We could look at it versus earnings, versus cash flow, versus dividends, versus all kinds of stuff. Assets are very extended relative to the fundamentals that support those assets. So what is their meaning? Oh, we know that they've gotten expensive because people are pouring money into ETFs and passive funds. We've written many commentaries and talked on these calls about how passive is a wonderful thing if very few people are doing it, and it's not so wonderful if a lot are doing it. And when everybody's doing it, it's downright dangerous. And we can talk as much or a little about that as people want. But in the meantime, is it rational for everybody to be buying something without any analysis, without any evaluation? You know our answer. So back to, is it a cyclical world? For those that believe it's a linear world, probably no need to listen to the rest of this presentation. But for people that believe in a cyclical world, yeah, there are cycles. There's summer, there's winter. People in summer might know it's a good time to buy their winter clothes, and in winter it's a good time to prepare for summer because you know it's coming. 10 years into economic growth, people probably ought to prepare that someday there'll be a recession. 10 years into a bull market, I think it's wise to know that there may be a bear market. It's also, we've talked about passive strategies do well late in bull markets. They do terribly in bear markets. Growth and momentum, and passive is, of course, a momentum strategy, do well late in bull cycles. Value does well the rest of the time. And we'll also talk a little bit about within value, there are the people, which is most everybody that still admits to being value, has become a quality franchise person. There's very few Graham and Dodd people left. That's kind of interesting. So what to make of the quality growth that everybody's buying? Like I say, the world's cyclical. Things change. All right, we understand that 100 years ago is a long, long time and not so relevant, but the point's relevant. The Apple of 1917 was U.S. Steel. Yeah, the Google is AT&T. What you've seen is companies become less relevant other than the oil companies, the steel companies, and the commodities companies, and the ag companies have really lost relevance. 1967, also a long time ago, but maybe it's more relevant. But the Apple of 1967 was IBM, which is struggled over the last 10, 15 years, but it's consistently gone down. But the hoo-hoo, the ones that everybody wanted to own in 1967, IBM struggled, AT&T was broken up, Kodak went bankrupt, GM went bankrupt, the oil companies had to merge together, Sears went bankrupt, GE, I think you're all aware of what's become of them, Polaroid went bankrupt. So, you know, you look at the crop of 2017, they're good companies, and we don't expect their demise. We suspect they will keep doing well for a long, long time. But unless things go perfect, their stocks won't do as well. To look a little more in that, we've talked about this in the past, the increase, this is not the market cap, the increase over the last 2.5 years, $2.3 trillion. When I came into business, you could buy the entire market for less than a trillion. So these companies should do well, but people's opinion of these companies will change. Like we say, the world is a cyclical place. This shows the percent of funds outperforming. Active managers do better, passive do better. Active do better, passive do better. That's the way of the world. You can do a very similar chart, which we, as you know, have done in the past, showing value doing better, growth doing better. You can do similar charts showing financial assets versus real assets, and we've shown you those over the last few years. And then even within value, there is the quality franchises that everybody's buying. And there is the Graham and Dodd, or as it's officially referred to, Cigarva investing, that was all the rage when I came into the business. Graham and Dodd was the Bible, and everybody paid attention to it. And now nobody does. It's amazing the articles that have come to our attention over the last 3-4 months. Questioning whether book value has any value whatsoever, questioning whether assets really even matter, that what should be capitalized now are ideas, as if every idea becomes worth a fortune as opposed to just a few of them. So, quality. Let's look at this. Coca-Cola, quality company. Here it looks like a small blur, but you can see in the Nifty 50 days, that was one of the big ones, and then the company did really well. The stock did miserably. Then in 1998-99, under the index fund mania, the company got very expensive again. Everybody loved franchises. Everybody was saying, all right, Warren Buffett has redefined this. He's so much smarter than his mentor, which may be true. He's buying franchises. He's aware that franchises have value beyond the assets. That is absolutely true. People are saying Coca-Cola is a Buffett stock. That is true. Where they got confused was Warren Buffett bought it at $2.50, and people were buying it at $44, feeling comfortable as they bought a Buffett stock, and you can see what happened to them. They lost a lot of money for a lot of years. Now it's back up. Now everybody wants to own quality growth companies again. Quality growth is the new value. We suspect this will end like the last two times that people felt overly comfortable in franchises. But fine, if people want to own them, at least own them with your eyes open. It doesn't matter what we think about that. What does matter is whether we're right about the alternatives. Others are buying quality, which has been in a 10-year massive bull market. As I said at the beginning of this, people have a choice between things that have been going up a lot for 10 years or things that have been going down a lot for 10 years. It's an easy choice for us. So finding really, really good companies that just happen to be in markets that have been dropping for a decade. Certainly, China's a huge country. Brazil's a huge country. Eighth and the best, biggest in the world. Russia, I think, is the 11th biggest in that country. Certainly, there's some companies there that are worth a lot, and the markets put them on sale. Let's put this in perspective. People were kind of amused a few years ago and actually astonished that we did the chart saying that Apple was bigger than the entire country of Russia. Land-wise, the biggest country in the world, one of the top economies with the most resources. That seems almost quaint. Now you've got Apple at twice Russia. You have four companies, just one company's market cap bigger than the eighth largest economy in the world. Fascinating. What got me started on all these analyses, I think I've mentioned in the past, is a presentation I heard in 1999, the last Tech Mania, that compared Intel to India. They both had market caps of $400 billion. All these years later, maybe you've gotten back your money on Intel, not quite. India's gone up a lot. So, yeah, we hope the future brings good things for Apple and Amazon and Microsoft and Google, that we suspect their stocks will not even begin to keep up with some of the real great companies we're finding in Brazil and Russia and China and other places. So that's where we are. We're well into it. But what's happened after 10 years of the rest of the world underperforming the U.S.? It's accelerated. That's what's happened. So here's the market this year, not counting the U.S. The Nasdaq's still up a lot this year, and the rest of the markets are roughly up. So this is continued massive, and this feels a bit like a capitulation. It was amazing a month or two ago how quickly some markets were dropping. Felt a little bit like January of 2016. Here's another way of looking at it. The U.S. versus the rest of the world. The U.S. is now very expensive, the most expensive ever versus the rest of the world. We've talked in the past how 1989, when Japan became worth as much as the rest of the world put together, that ended poorly for Japan. The U.S. is now an acme worth well more than the rest of the world put together. The U.S. will continue to do well. The U.S. stock market might prove to be dangerous. So, while the U.S. economy's been growing moderately and the market's gone up huge and the Nasdaq's gone up 7 times, the emerging markets, being emerging, have grown a good bit faster than the U.S. has. So 10 years are growing much faster than the U.S., and instead of being up 7 times like the Nasdaq, it's not gone up at all. So stocks relative to the size of the economy have become much, much, much more attractive. And also, it's worth pointing out that why people made no money owning the emerging markets, if they did whatever they told them to do by ETFs, they actually lost a fair amount of money. The ETFs, there's no free lunch. They've underperformed the very markets they're supposed to be tracking. So a lot of good companies that happen to be in emerging markets are on sale. There's also a lot of good companies that just happen to be asset-rich. I mentioned earlier there seems to be almost a disdain for assets out there right now. That's a beautiful thing. Assets clearly still have value. So real assets versus financial assets, we've shown you this in the past, but this is really mind-blowing how cheap real assets are relative to financial assets. Certainly there's some good companies. This is commodities in general. So we like the fact that even though the population of the world's grown and the economy has grown and demand for assets and the resources has grown, the prices have gotten cheaper. But we're not buying commodities. We're buying specific things that happen to be undervalued. We like things that are trading not only low in price, but way lower than the cost of producing incremental supply in the future. It's interesting that up until a couple of days ago, oil had bounced all the way back up to about its incentive price, while the price of natural gas continued to go down. You know, people used to like the fact that natural gas is, you know, much cleaner and easier to use in certain ways other than storage. And so here you have a cleaner, cheaper fuel that's gone down relative to oil. Another cheap, clean fuel is uranium, which also up until a few months back had gotten very, very cheap, down from 137, this chart shows even higher, down to 18 and now back to 27. So a third of what we think would be the price required to get people to bring more uranium out of the ground. Platinum not long ago traded at a higher price than gold and traded at 5 times the price of palladium. Now it trades at a huge discount to gold and trades at less than palladium. That's fascinating. Silver, twice during my career, is traded at $50 an ounce. It's an incredible bargain now. So these in particular seem very, very underpriced. But it gets better. So not only are these underpriced, gas is underpriced if you buy it on the market. If you buy it on the stock market, it's even better. People used to love Range Petroleum. Now look how much it's underperformed the very commodity that they own. So gas underpriced, Range outrageously underpriced. Uranium, after years and years of falling, starting to bounce a little bit. If somebody told me at the beginning of the summer that uranium was going to go up 20% and Cameco was going to win, flat out win, a major legal battle with the Canadian government, I would have figured the stock might double. As you can see here, the stock's down. So it's worth way more than it was earlier in the summer, and it is trading for less. Also, most other uranium stocks also are down. They're starting to bounce back, but they're down way underlegging. So uranium's trading at a third of what we think it's worth, and uranium held in the ground by these companies is a big discount to that. Gold, we've talked enough about gold in the past, although maybe you can't talk enough about it now. It's become so incredibly cheap, and there'll be more in the upcoming commentary that I need to finish. And here you can see it's one of three times in history where gold has been this cheap relative to stocks. We can talk about gold relative to stocks, we can talk about gold relative to wages, we can talk gold relative to everything. We've talked about the cost of mining, we've compared it to the amount of dollars, the cost of dollars. And gold is very, very attractively valued, but once again, where gold's gone down a bit over the last 7 years, gold held by the mining companies is 85% off sale. That's a fascinating thing. So gold miners, yeah, truly, truly a bargain, right back to where they were in January of 2016. That seemed like a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity, but sometimes you get a second chance. And RIA is cheap, but I'm sure you're hearing everybody tell you interest rates are going up, and that's bad for gold. Interest rates up, gold down, that's simple. The facts are almost exactly the opposite. Interest rates went up a lot in the 70s, and gold went up big. Interest rates went down in the 80s and 90s, and gold went down pretty meaningfully. Interest rates gone up after that, and gold went up. Since then, it's been times where it's correlated and times where it's not correlated. But interest rates don't matter. It's real interest rates that matter. And usually when rates are rising, they are lagging the inflation rate. And so don't pay attention to the people that are trying to mislead you on that. So anyhow, the NASDAQ, the FANG stocks, and quality companies and a lot of other things are great. It's just that they're very, very expensive. And we've given a quick overview of some of the things you've heard before. The things are real bargains. So this shows just how attractively valued things in the portfolio are now. It's getting back close to January 2016 sort of levels. Most any way you want to look at it, many of these stocks are worth multiples of what they're selling, in our opinion. So people can go out and buy bonds and lock in their 3%, or they can buy stocks that may double, but there's no catalyst. We don't know when. And so what to do with that? Many of the better investors of our time have pointed out that you can be patient. And you can, without patience, go out and lock in your 3%, as we say, or you can figure, all right, I'll make a lot of money, I'll just be patient, wait for it to happen. And we think the return on patience is always good, but it is unusually high right now. Yeah. If doubling your money takes a year, that's a wonderful thing. But if it takes 2 years, 3 years, 4 years, still a pretty wonderful thing. Takes 7 years, that's a double-digit return. If it takes 10 years, that's more than twice what the bond market is going to be, even if you go out long-term. So feels a whole lot like January 2016 again. We're liking what we see, and with that, let's take questions.
At this time, if you'd like to ask a question, please press star followed by the number 1 on your telephone keypad. If you're calling from a speakerphone, please make sure your mute function is off to ensure your signal can reach our equipment. Again, star 1 to ask a question. And first, we'll go to Brian Wright from Columbus. Your line is open.
Hi. Have you guys got any thoughts on Italy and the banking situation there?
Our approach to investing is to look around the world and price businesses based on what we think the right way to value it. So some businesses will use book value, and some will use earnings, and some will use cash flow, and so on. And we'll look at them with banks. We'll start with book value, but we have to do a whole lot of adjustment to that sometimes. And then secondly, we risk adjust things. And so we want to discount for everything we own, where if we were to buy, we might be willing to buy Johnson & Johnson at a 10% discount to what we think it's worth. It's just nowhere near there. but with technology companies and retailers, we tend to want bigger discounts because they don't have the same barriers to entry. With banks, we want big discounts because they're easily levered 10-1, plus or minus. So historically, we haven't owned a lot of banks, but when we have, it's been when you can buy some of the better banks in our country at a distressed price because people don't like that country. So in the past, we've owned good banks in Thailand and in India and in Russia. We still do. We currently nibbled a little bit in Turkey. So as Italy keeps getting cheaper and cheaper, it's certainly on our radar screen. So it's possible. But places like Italy and China and other places, we tend to have less confidence than others do, which means we need a bigger discount than others. So, yes, we're looking. Whether we buy or not, I can't tell you.
And we'll go to our next question. Again, if you'd like to ask a question, please press star 1. Next is Rick Seidel from Ben. Your line is open.
Thank you. Two questions, actually. You talked about your price target on something like Cameco, predicated on the price of uranium going to certain levels. I was wondering if you could do the same thing for Range, what your price would be if the price of natural gas went to 4 to 7, that sort of thing. And then secondly, you just stated you risk adjust things. And I was just wondering if you could comment on the level to which you stress test ideas that you put in the portfolio. And I understand the commodities have been out of favor, gold miners and such, but there's a number of stocks that are really hit some air pockets, and I'm thinking specifically of the Diebold Nixdorf, the Dundee, things like that. And I was just wondering if those are just one-off, or if there's a little bit more rigor that you maybe apply to the process.
Certainly. Now, those are very good questions that get to the whole crux of what we do. Let's start with Range and natural resources in general. Natural resources, we tend to, as you mentioned, look at the incentive price. What would it take to get people not just to pull it out of the ground, but to replace it as they're pulling it out, going concern sort of things. And so If Range used to always sell at a premium to what we thought those were worth, but it took a big hit, and we were able to buy it cheap, a lot cheaper than it is now, even although we still find it very attractive here. And so we'll run numbers like 375 gas. Yes, we'll stress test it to other levels. We'll also assume that commodities always have and always will get to their incentive price, but as we talked earlier, we don't know when, and so we want bigger discounts because we don't know the timing. So we do want decent discounts, but things like gas usually don't stay depressed as long as things like uranium, and so we do put those in there. I don't know that we give out the exact numbers, but we do think that gas is selling below what it's worth, and that Range is worth quite a bit more than it's selling, even after the recent bounce. We do view them as pretty well managed, and so it doesn't have as steep a discount as some other ones. But I'll also point out again, we resource companies, especially, this doesn't apply to Range, but ones that are dealing in other countries, especially some of the ones with less developed rule of law. In 2008, and again in 2016, we were able to create diversified portfolios of resources around the world. And in 2008, we lost on a couple of them, one in Venezuela and one in Bolivia, and the rest of them went up a lot, so we had a really good year. And then some of you can remember in 2016, that same thing, diversified at really distressed prices. Unfortunately, Peabody decided to steal the company from shareholders, and that was unfortunate. We still had a really, really good year because the rest of them went up a lot. You know, we've had success doing the same thing with utilities and phone companies, and you name it. One country will do something that hurts our profitability. Another one will do something that helps, and it's usually worked out very, very well. But the point is, we expect to be wrong on a third of our names. You know, we're humans. Humans are wrong, or computers, but we expect to be wrong. We're doing our best to appraise a business, the marketplace, which is millions of people thinking as a herd, come up with their own appraisal. The herd has lots and lots of people with lots and lots of knowledge and input from all over, and sometimes gets it very right, better than we can. The herd quite often does what herds are famous for, and that's losing their mind. And that's where we get a huge advantage, and that's why we have been over the decades right 2/3 of the time, plus or minus, and plus been able to make more money when we're right than we lose when we're wrong. But we expect to be wrong sometimes. Diebold, we still hope things turn out pretty well for them, but right now it's worth less than it was than we thought it was when we came in, because they had this option to for Nixdorf people to put things back to them. So they had a high level of debt. Now it's higher because they had to make good. So what was possibly an ordinary downturn has become more than an ordinary downturn. And so I don't know that we'll ever make our money back in that one. Meanwhile, we've made some good money in other ones. Yeah, maybe the same can be said for Dundee. It's buy some good franchises, but then they change management, and they change management again, and they end up buying oil in Africa and then selling it at the bottom, and building a casino that costs a lot more than any of us thought it would cost. Yet there's still lots and lots of value there. We suspect it's worth a lot more than it's selling at now, but I don't think this is going to go down as one of our big winners. It's not been a good one. So with our way of doing things, we expect to have plenty of them where we're wrong, and we expect to have hopefully a lot more where we're right, and more importantly, a tremendous upside, especially in this market. We like the fact that there's really tremendous upside on most of what we own, because we do think the danger in the market is unusually high right now. As you all know, the level of debt in the U.S. is the highest ever. The level of debt in most of the developed world is the highest ever. And I'm not just talking about nominal. I'm talking about as a percentage of GDP. It's over 100 here. It's outrageous in Japan. It's outrageous in China. It's very challenging in most of Europe. Interest rates have been going up. Governments across the world have become more nationalistic, as raised from. So we think all of us are going to continue to stub our toes into the future, but we also think that possibly significant profits can be made on portfolios because people are so afraid that they're selling things at a real bargain. And then as Howard Marks always points out, and he's got a new book out, but he's always pointing out that the real money's lost in the things that people think are safe. My words, not his, the quality franchises. So we think that people should not avoid risk. They should minimize it, diversify it, get overpaid for it. And I think we're taking average risk and getting way above average returns. And we think people that are buying the popular stocks are prospectively getting below average returns with a lot more risk than they can imagine. But certainly we've got a few companies that have not worked out so well.
Thanks very much.
And next we'll go to Gary Magnuson from Morgan Stanley. Your line is open.
Yes, Dave. I was wondering if you had any opinion on kind of the home building area out here in Seattle, like Weyerhaeuser supplies the home builders, and the home building stocks are cheap, and so is seems like Weyerhaeuser's come down. And I was curious, on the auto industry, they're all kind of down in the dumps, though it is, they've had a lot of auto sales, except for maybe Tesla, I guess. Curious if what your opinion are of those two areas in terms of looking at them long term.
We have a home builder in Russia, and as home builders keep getting cheaper here, they get more interesting to us the more they come down. Now, one area of the country to another, I can't tell you, but a lot of these have business a lot of places. So whether it's the lumber companies or the forest products companies or the people that actually build the houses, certainly the cheaper the better. And there are, that's one of the things we've talked about this time and the last couple conference calls, that why the NASDAQ might still be up big on the year. Home builders are getting cheaper, and a lot of consumer stocks are getting cheaper, and a lot of utilities are getting cheaper, a lot of everything is getting cheaper. If this continues, certainly you'll see home builders in there. Now, emerging markets you get more growth for cheaper value, so sometimes we get there first, but we're happy to look at good home builders at good prices. But I can't give you a specific answer. Autos, yes. Autos are a fascinating industry. There's few barriers to entry. There's dozens of companies. Probably hundreds of companies have gone bankrupt over the last century, and now you've got different technologies. Is it going to be electric or hybrids or fuel cells or continued internal combustion? And it's very capital intensive. So it's another one of those industries I alluded to earlier that we want a fairly big discount. But as you suggest, the market's given us big discounts. So we do own Hyundai. We've got another one that we spent a lot of time on that we might buy. And there's a few others that are on our radar screen. So there are good companies that have survived and grown that are trading at massive discounts, not just on PE because it's a cyclical business, but big discounts to the net assets they own, to the book value they own. So there's a price for everything, and we agree with you. Autos are getting to interesting prices.
And we'll take our next question. It comes from Chris Mattini from TIFF. Your line is open.
Hey, Dave. It's Brad. I just one question for you on your kind of put program that you've had on various times over the years, in the last couple of years. Could you just talk a little bit about how you feel that's gone and sort of what you've learned from those investments? Thanks.
Certainly. We like to take what the market's giving us. For most of my career, the premium on options was pretty high. So there's been times in the past where we wrote options against the portfolio, and that's worked pretty well. Yeah, after 30-some-odd years of premiums being mostly too high, most everybody is very reluctant to want to buy premium. They'd rather sell premium. But as anybody that's read or seen The Big Short, they can see that sometimes premium gets too small, and it usually gets too small actually when it ought to be big. It was amazing that when the housing and mortgage market was clearly at an unsustainable level, people like Poulton and Burry and these guys were able to buy premium at a cheap price. And of course, as inevitably happens to people that buy values, you have to suffer for a few years before you get rewarded, and they suffered, and then they got rewarded big time. Now, with the market defined by the S&P as far and away the most expensive it's ever been on a price to sales, and amongst the first or second most expensive ever on price to book value, price to GDP, price to replacement value, price to cyclically adjusted earnings, you name it, the market would have to be viewed as more vulnerable than usual. And since it's been first or second, depending on how you define it, longest time without a correction, maybe it's more due for a correction than it ever has been. So we are not predicting a correction at all, other than to say we are predicting that they've not been outlawed, and they will happen. We don't know when or how much, but the price of a put should be at an all-time high right now, because the risk is at all-time high right now. And so we looked and said, is it at all-time high? No. Is it even normal? No. It's the lowest. The lowest ever. All right. So we're value people. Buying very valuable things at very cheap prices is what we do. And we win some and we lose some, but we like to make a lot more when we win. So we've been buying these options, and what was already one of the longest markets without a correction has become, in some people's opinion, the longest. It's gone for almost 2 years since we started doing this. Up till 2 years ago, we had never done this. Now we've been doing it, and the plan has not changed at all. The plan is to keep buying these until either the market gets around to correcting, or the market comes up with a more realistic price. But if they want to keep selling these things to us at way too cheap a price, we're happy to own them. And as to what I learned, I can't answer that until the cycle is completed. When it's completed, we'll see how much we made or lost, and then we can talk about what we've learned. But right now, we're still thrilled to be able to pay record low implied vol for a market that undoubtedly is going to have record high vol sometime in the next few years. We just don't know when. So unlike Burian Poulton and those guys, we're just doing 1%. We're not losing that much. And when it works out for us, we're not going to become billionaires. But we think the return could be nice.
And again, if you have a question, please press star 1. Next, we'll take Anthony Eichler from Stonebridge Capital. Your line is open.
Hey, Dave. How are you?
Good. How are you?
Dave?
Yep.
A couple of your holdings have a quick question on. First, with all the options you have in gold and gold opportunities, you sell Barrick's with a merger, Newmont, clearly where all the miners are. Newcrest consistently is one of your largest holdings. What in terms of risk-reward there do you like in terms of why that's one of your larger holdings? And my second question would really be on Gazprom, and it was proposed to me by an investor. The level of confidence you have when you look at something in Russia like a Gazprom, which clearly trades at a huge discount, when you start looking at numbers, the confidence you have in numbers, the confidence your team has in numbers. Just a couple quick comments on that. Both of those are very large holdings of yours, and clearly you have compelling reasons for that, and I'd just be curious your thoughts behind that.
Yeah, no, they're very different. As I was talking before on some of the resources or technology companies where some have worked well and some haven't. Gazprom's pretty similar. We look at risk on a portfolio basis, not on a company-by-company basis. So if we have 10 companies and a couple of them don't work out for us, then the other 7 or 8 make us a lot of money. We view that as low risk, high return. So we've been very happy to go into emerging markets that we think are risky enough that we want a 50% discount. And we've wanted 50% discounts for many years in Russia and Brazil and India and China and some smaller countries. And from time to time, even parts of Europe, we wanted 50% discounts. And that served us well because we've been burned a few times and we've been rewarded handsomely over the years. And so let's take Gazprom. You start out with the best gas company on earth. Arguably, they have the most gas, some of the cheapest prices, the longest reserves, the best infrastructure. They're located near Europe. Who needs it? They're building pipelines to China. Who wants it? Great company. The Barrick will be correct, too, when they say you need a big discount because this thing is corrupt. Yeah, Russia has corruption there. If you pay $3 billion for a pipeline and you look at what you got, you probably cannot identify a $3 billion worth, maybe a half a billion or more was siphoned off somewhere. And they've had to help finance the Olympics and whatnot. So we think that it's good to have a discount. Now, they can point out different things when Jim Grant was writing about it and said, when we say this is 3x earnings, we mean 3x the earnings that are left over after stealing. Yeah. And so, not that we approve of the stealing, we don't, but this thing is cheap. This thing's 3x earnings. If you, in a report we read the other day, it says if you subtract out their subsidiaries, it's 1x the remaining earnings. If you look at it on a book value basis, it's no more than a 70% discount. And book value grows every year after the dividend is paid even. And if you look at it on a reserve basis, what are you paying for the reserves? With most of the big majors, you're paying $15 to $20 per barrel. Now, we wouldn't touch Russia at those prices. We would want half price before we even think about it. So $7.50 to $10 per barrel. But certainly $5 is interesting. $3 would be amazing, isn't it? This thing is less than $1 per barrel. So this is a great company that's very profitable with massive reserves. It's trading arguably at a 95% discount to what it's worth. happy to own that. Newcrest is very high quality, arguably the best gold company in the world, although that's a subjective thing. But they've been one of the better run. They're one of the bigger. They're pretty diversified. You know, several good mines in different countries. And they've been smarter than most, starting the bar low, but they've been smarter than most management teams in terms of their asset allocation. So we've looked at resources, but especially at gold, and we're saying the bulls are right that the price needs to go up a lot, and the bears are right that it's a poorly managed business with lots of obstacles, lower reserve grades, higher costs, bigger geopolitical risk, bigger management risk, chemical risk, and geological risk. And so that means two things. That means you want to buy these things at big discounts, and it means you want to diversify. So we've done two things. We've bought the Newcrest that did the diversification for us and are better managed than most. So that's a rare thing, a big, well-managed company in this industry. So we're happy to have that as one of our big holdings. But we also want to diversify. And so we have big reserves that are attached to small-cap companies, which that's sort of like 1999 was, when you can buy small caps that are actually big companies. And we're buying big reserves all over the world. We're getting different. We're diversifying the geopolitics. We're diversifying the management. We're diversifying the ore grade risk and the chemistry risk, and you name it. So we've got our Newcrest, and then we've got a portfolio where we're kind of building our own Newcrest, if you will, by providing our own asset allocation and diversification. We're pleased to have both of those in our portfolio.
Thank you.
And again, if you have a question, please press star followed by the number one on your telephone keypad. I'll pause for just a moment to give everyone a chance to signal. We'll go next to Patricia Neubiller from Merrill Lynch. Your line is open.
David, it's always wonderful to get into your head. So, I'm going to toss out a couple questions just to see what kind of thoughts you might have about it. So, one is the budding pot industry, particularly in Canada, that's just gone live. And then the other one would be infrastructure, should it ever come to pass in this country.
Be happy to talk about those.
Thank you.
You know, people tend to refer to us as contrarian. We're not offended by that, because most of the time we are somewhat contrarian, although we're not contrarian for contrarian's sake. If everybody hates something, often they're right, but it's a good place to fish for ideas. So we think independently. Don't buy things just because people don't like them. On the other hand, when everybody loves something, when people are going nuts, paying crazy prices for things, people I know tell me stories about land that they've sold to some of these cannabis companies at 10 times what it's worth, because these guys are swimming in money. And when you see so many startups, and if we were talking a year ago, we'd be talking about a cryptocurrency and how they were popping up left and right every day. And there's a lot of things to like about cryptocurrency, that when they're popping up left and right, if everybody's doing something, the scarcity value is gone. And if everybody's stampeding into things at higher and higher prices, then you're unlikely to find a bargain. And so I have not paid very much attention, but I'm aware that everybody's pouring into the cannabis stocks, and I don't see the barriers to entry. I don't see why, when it's all said and done, Philip Morris or the alcohol companies or the Pfizers and Lillys aren't going to be the ones making the money. I don't know. That's not a prediction. I'm just saying I don't see the barriers, and I do see people pouring into the things. And I'm not against them. I hope they do fine, but we let other people play the popular things, and we'll sit it out. Infrastructure needs to be built. The U.S. needs it. Europe needs it. Japan needs it. Whatever. We agree with that, but all those countries are effectively broke. We like infrastructure in the emerging markets mostly is where, you know, we're happy to buy it in the U.S. if we get a bargain someday, but the U.S. tends to have a habit of spending the money into transfer payments instead of into investment, where emerging markets, they tend to be building trains and dams and railroads and highways and airports, and we, depending on how you define infrastructure, we own ports, and we've looked at airports, and we own phone infrastructure, and we own railroad infrastructures, and we like infrastructure. We think it's important. We think it's a good use of capital. But I don't think we're on the verge of buying any U.S. infrastructure right now.
Thank you.
And at this time, I'd like to turn it back to David Ivan for any closing remarks.
All right, thank you. And thanks, everybody, for joining us. It certainly is an important time to be talking about some of the values and anti-values in the market. And we'll see what the market has in store, but we're really pleased with the valuations we see, and we're also very thankful for all of your support. Thank you.
And that concludes our call for today. Thank you for your participation. You may now disconnect.